Hello and welcome back to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, and I'm thrilled to have you with us for another journey into the stories that are shaping our world.
And I'm Sam Aster. Our mission today, as always, is to take a stack of the most important sources from today's news and unpack them for you, ensuring you're well-informed without feeling overwhelmed.
That's right, and today we're doing a comprehensive deep dive into the Wall Street Journal for Friday, August 8th, 2025.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to pull out the most important nuggets, connect the dots, and explore the surprising implications across global affairs, the economy, cutting-edge technology, and even into the very fabric of American life and culture. So get ready to dive in with us.
What truly stands out from the pages of the journal today is how many of these seemingly disparate stories actually weave together, painting a vivid picture of the powerful interconnected forces shaping our world right now.
Okay, let's unpack this. We're starting with a major geopolitical development from the Middle East, a story that carries immense weight. Israel's security cabinet has officially approved a plan for the military to take control of Gaza City.
Right.
This is a move Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has pledged will eventually extend to the entire enclave, signaling a significant escalation with immediate, far-reaching implications for the region.
One striking detail the journal highlights is that this plan follows an overnight vote, driven by Israel's hope that it will compel Hamas back to the negotiating table. On Israel's terms, perhaps even leading to a pause in military operations.
Yeah.
However, Hamas has swiftly issued a stark warning, vowing a heavy and costly price for any occupying forces and calling for urgent international intervention.
Yeah.
The controversy surrounding this plan, both domestically within Israel and on the international stage, it really indicates the deep divisions and incredibly high stakes involved in any decisive action in Gaza right now.
Indeed, the international pushback is considerable and growing. France and the UK, for instance, have publicly vowed to recognize a Palestinian state as early as September.
That's a big step.
It is. And just last month, a significant bloc of 28 countries, a group that includes major allies like Italy, Canada, Austria, Spain, the Netherlands, Japan, Greece, and Belgium, issued a joint call for an immediate end to the conflict.
Mm.
But the truly intriguing aspect emerges when you look at the dissent within Israel itself.
Yeah.
The military chief, Eyal Zamir, has openly voiced his opposition to a full takeover.
Really?
Yes, citing fears of potential Hamas traps and the critical need to rest exhausted troops. This echoes warnings from former defense minister Yoav Gallant, who also cautioned against such a move before his removal last year.
Right, I remember that.
And on a deeply poignant note, hostage families are strongly against these new plans, staging emotional protests outside the cabinet. They've stated unequivocally that their loved ones face immediate danger, underscoring a profound human cost and a desperate plea from those most directly affected.
Yeah.
It suggests a significant rift, doesn't it, between the military command and some political figures?
Absolutely. And placing this within the wider context, you know, supporters of the plan contend it represents the only viable path forward, particularly given Hamas's continued refusal to disarm.
Okay.
Their argument is rooted in the belief that hostages face increasing risk for maltreatment if decisive military action isn't taken. This brings to the forefront a crucial consideration, the immense humanitarian crisis unfolding in Gaza.
That's dire.
The journal reports that the U.S. is now considering a significantly larger role in aid distribution, with plans to scale up the U.S.-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation from 4 to 16 sites, aiming to operate up to 24 hours a day.
16 sites. Wow.
Yeah, the stated intention behind this initiative is to prevent Hamas from diverting aid intended for the civilian population. However, this raises a challenging question about aid distribution in conflict zones.
Right.
This U.S.-led initiative has been notably boycotted by the United Nations and other major aid groups, who argue that it fundamentally violates neutrality principles and, perhaps more critically, forces desperate civilians into dangerous combat zones just to collect food.
Oh, that's a huge concern.
It is. Gaza health authorities claim this approach has tragically resulted in hundreds of civilian deaths, although Israel disputes the inflation of these figures. The core tension here is a dire one. How do you effectively get aid to those who desperately need it while navigating the profound security concerns and ethical complexities of operating in an active war zone?
It seems almost impossible. And currently, Israel already controls approximately 75% of Gaza's territory. Yet the journal highlights a stark reality.
Mm.
Only a small fraction of the more than 2 million displaced inhabitants are actually living within those areas,
mm-hmm.
which truly drives home the sheer scale of the displacement and the immense challenges confronting any humanitarian effort. regardless of its good intentions.
Exactly. The numbers are just staggering.
Okay, shifting gears now to another major global flashpoint. President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin appear to be at a new make-or-break moment regarding the conflict in Ukraine.
Yeah, this has been brewing.
The Journal reports that Trump has significantly intensified economic pressure on Moscow, threatening severe sanctions on countries that continue to purchase Russian energy. This includes a particularly aggressive move, hitting India with a steep 50% tariff on its goods shipped to the U.S.
50%? That's huge.
It is. It's a high-stakes play designed to force a resolution to the ongoing conflict.
What truly stands out here is how this aligns with Trump's long-held belief, you know, that complex foreign policy challenges hinge on historic deals struck between two powerful leaders.
Right, the personal deal-making approach.
Exactly. The Journal reveals he's reportedly fuming that he hasn't been able to halt the war 200 days into his second presidency, especially given his earlier claim that he could stop it in just 24 hours.
Mm-hmm. A claim that drew a lot of attention.
For sure. The White House is actively pushing for a three-way meeting that would include Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. However, Putin has only expressed openness in principle to talks with Zelensky.
In principle.
Yeah, frequently questioning his legitimacy and stating quite directly that they are still far from creating such conditions for such a meeting. This highlights the fundamental chasm in their positions and the immense complexity of achieving any meaningful diplomatic breakthrough, particularly when one side is questioning the very standing of the other.
This situation is undoubtedly proving to be a true test of Trump's much-touted deal-making skills. The Journal reports that Zelensky and key European governments remain absolute firm in their stance. They will not recognize Russian control over any conquered territory.
A non-starter for Ukraine and its allies.
Precisely. Which, as we know, is a key Kremlin demand. There's also widespread skepticism among experts that Putin is genuinely serious about a deal at this juncture. Analysts like Alina Polyakova suggest Putin has done his homework on Trump and has been remarkably adept at sending signals of openness to diplomacy while simultaneously and relentlessly pressing his war aims on the battlefield.
So mixed signals at best.
Exactly. Meanwhile, the conflict on the ground remains a brutal, grinding war of attrition. Russia continues to make incremental, albeit costly, gains in eastern Ukraine, particularly around key strongholds like Pokrovsk and Chasiv Yar.
But at a high cost, you said.
Very high casualties, yes. Conversely, Ukrainian forces have managed to push back in the Sumy region, reclaiming land and two villages by effectively targeting Russian logistics, showing their strategic adaptability.
Right.
However, the disparity in manpower remains a critical and sobering issue. Ukraine currently has only one soldier for every four or five Russians, and Russia continues to bolster its ranks by adding an estimated 9,000 personnel monthly.
9,000 a month. That's a significant reinforcement rate.
It is. The conflict is also defined by Russia's heavy and devastating use of guided aviation bombs and drones, making it a highly destructive modern war, where technology and sheer volume of fire inflict immense damage. This stark reality on the ground makes any diplomatic solution incredibly challenging and incredibly fragile.
And this brings to the forefront a crucial consideration for Trump, right? If he emerges from these talks empty-handed, he faces a significant decision point.
Yeah, what are his options?
He could either dramatically increase pressure on Russia or, as he demonstrated earlier this year, entirely abandon the peace process, potentially cutting off intelligence and military support for Ukraine.
A stark choice.
Very stark. The Journal's opinion section offers a profound human perspective on this, highlighting what it calls the Sophie's choice that Ukrainians face. They view any territorial concessions not merely as a political negotiation, but as the ultimate sacrifice of family and friends.
It's deeply personal for them.
Absolutely. The piece even cites legal definitions of genocide, particularly concerning the forcible transfers of children and cultural erasure, underscoring the deeply moral and existential dimensions of this conflict for the Ukrainian people. It's not just a strategic game. For them, it's about survival and identity.
A powerful reminder of the human cost. Okay, let's shift from geopolitical strategy to the intricate world of global economics. The Wall Street Journal brings us a significant report. President Trump's ongoing tariff war has now inflicted an estimated, get this, $12 billion in losses on global automakers.
$12 billion. Wow. That's not pocket change.
Not at all. This isn't just a minor hit. It represents their biggest financial setback since the pandemic. And for many in the industry, it's believed to be just the beginning of a prolonged period of disruption.
One striking detail the Journal highlights is the sheer scale of the financial impact on individual companies. Toyota, for instance, has specifically reported a staggering $3 billion hit to its operating profit just from these tariffs.
$3 billion for Toyota alone.
Yeah. And looking ahead, the company projects an even more burdensome $9.5 billion impact through next March, a forecast that could lead to a dramatic 44% decline in its net profit.
A 44% decline. That could cripple them.
It's a huge risk. The total reported hit from higher import duties for the world's 10 largest automakers, excluding Chinese manufacturers, now stands at that considerable $11.8 billion figure.
So it's widespread.
Definitely. And while the immediate obvious responses for car makers would be to either raise prices or move production to the U.S., the journal emphasizes that both are incredibly difficult to implement quickly due to the complex global supply chains and immense capital investments required.
Right. These shifts take years, not months.
Exactly. Many manufacturers are also wary of raising prices too high, fueling a nasty tweet from Trump, or, more significantly, a dent in already sensitive consumer demand. This really illustrates the precarious tightrope car makers are walking between maintaining profitability and navigating unpredictable political pressures.
However, the White House has also introduced specific policies that, in some ways, partially offset these significant tariff hits for domestic automakers.
Oh, interesting. Like what?
Well, the journal points to the unwinding of climate regulations, which effectively spares Detroit the considerable cost of increasing unprofitable EV sales, thereby providing them a license to continue selling more lucrative, larger pickup trucks and SUVs.
Ah, okay. So easing environmental rules helps their bottom line.
Precisely. There's also the Big Beautiful Bill, a new initiative allowing buyers of U.S.-made vehicles to deduct up to $10,000 in loan interest payments starting next year, directly incentivizing domestic purchases.
A direct incentive for consumers to buy American-made.
Exactly. The clear overarching aim, as President Trump has repeatedly stated, is to see a substantial increase in U.S. production. We're already seeing this translate into action. General Motors, for instance, is expanding pickup production in Indiana and has concrete plans to move its Chevrolet Equinox and Blazer models from Mexico to U.S. factories by 2027.
A $4 billion investment, the article said.
That's right. A $4 billion investment. Honda is also actively trying to localize key parts production here. All of these moves are accelerating a pre-existing industry trend towards local for local manufacturing.
Building closer to the customer base?
Right. Essentially building cars closer to where they are sold, particularly in major markets like North America, Europe, and China, which are increasingly divided by different regulations and distinct consumer preferences. It's a complex, dynamic dance of incentives, pressures, and strategic shifts in global manufacturing.
And stepping back to consider the broader implications, we see a fascinating and somewhat counterintuitive trend. Despite the U.S. tariffs, China's exports actually defied expectations by accelerating growth in July by a robust 7.2%.
Even with the tariffs.
Yeah. While exports to the U.S. did fall significantly by 22% in July, China more than compensated by dramatically increasing exports to the rest of the world. It's a strategic redirection of trade that helped its overall economy grow by 5.3% in the first half of the year.
So the tariffs didn't necessarily cripple their overall export growth.
Not entirely, no. This begs the question, how effective are tariffs if trade can simply be redirected to other markets, rather than achieving the intended reshoring of jobs or a reduction in trade deficits?
That's a key question.
Conversely, German exports to the U.S. have fallen for the third straight month, down 2.1% in June, which a Commerce Bank economist explicitly stated shows Donald Trump's tariff policy is slowing down trade for their economy.
So Germany is feeling the pinch.
Definitely. Germany, as a key EU member, now faces a 15% tariff ceiling on chip exports to the U.S., but other sectors, including industrial production, are also feeling it. India, too, is facing a bumpy road ahead with that steep 50% tariff on its exports to the U.S.
Right, the one aimed at pressuring Russia.
Exactly. This paints a vivid picture of a global trade landscape in significant flux, with varied and complex impacts on different economies, showcasing both the resilience and vulnerability within the interconnected global system.
Okay, let's bring it back to the domestic front. President Trump is making concerted moves to reshape the economic landscape, starting with a significant nomination to the Federal Reserve.
Yes, the Fed nomination.
The Journal reports he will nominate Steven Mnuchin, currently the head of the White House Council of Economic Advisers, to fill a vacancy on the Federal Reserve Board of Governors on a short-term basis.
One striking detail the journal highlights is that this isn't just a standard appointment. Mirren is filling the seat of Fed Governor Adriana Kugler, who left unexpectedly.
Right.
This decision is strategically complicated because the White House might need to reserve this specific seat to install a different person to succeed Fed Chair Jerome Powell when his term as chair ends next May.
Ah, so it's about the chairmanship succession planning.
Potentially, yes. Powell's separate term on the board doesn't actually expire until early 2028, and no other current governor's term expires during Trump's time in office, making this particular position crucial for any potential change in Fed leadership or a shift in monetary policy direction.
Got it. And Mirren himself, what's his background?
He holds a PhD in economics from Harvard, and he's been a vocal critic of the Fed's policy under Powell, particularly its decision to lower interest rates last year. He's warned against what he calls doves, those who prioritize growth over inflation control.
Okay.
Believing their tolerance for inflation closer to 3% rather than the central bank's stated 2% target fundamentally undermines our democracy, the rule of law, and our institutions. He even stated that a little temporary economic weakness is a small price to pay for a permanent reduction in inflation.
Strong words. Definitely signals a more hawkish stance.
Very much so. And this begs the question, what is the future of the Fed's independence under this administration, especially since Mirren has also co-authored a paper advocating for a congressional overhaul?
An overhaul of the Fed.
Yes, one that would give the White House greater control to dismiss Fed appointees and limit the revolving door between the Fed and the executive branch, suggesting a potentially dramatic shift in the central bank's autonomy.
Wow. That would be a fundamental change. And it's not just the Federal Reserve, where we're seeing clear signs of presidential influence, right? Intel CEO Lip-Bu Tan.
Yeah, that's another developing story.
He's reportedly already at odds with his own board members over the struggling tech giant's future, specifically clashing over whether the company should remain in manufacturing or exit it entirely.
A huge strategic question for Intel.
Absolutely. Then President Trump unexpectedly entered the fray, publicly calling for Tan's ouster, claiming he's conflicted by business ties to China. This adds another layer of profound complexity and political pressure to an already challenging situation for Intel.
And placing this within the wider context, Intel, once the world's most valuable semiconductor company, has seen its market value cut in half since early last year.
Cut in half. That's brutal.
It is, largely due to its failure to foresee and adequately respond to the rapid rise of AI. While Intel states its board and management are aligned and committed to U.S. national security, an opinion piece in today's journal frames this whole situation as the tragedy of Intel.
The tragedy of Intel. Why?
The piece argues that the company has made itself vulnerable due to its heavy dependence on federal largesse, particularly the CHIPS Act.
Ah, the semiconductor manufacturing funding.
Exactly. The piece also notes that Mr. Tan has significant past investments in Chinese chip firms, only exiting one after U.S. sanctions were imposed. This analysis suggests Trump's attack on Tan may be less about pure national security and more about imposing direct political control over a company heavily reliant on federal aid.
Especially given the context you mentioned earlier.
Right. Especially given the sobering fact that the U.S. has lost 21,000 semiconductor manufacturing jobs in the last year, despite the CHIPS Act's intent. This really highlights the tension between stated industrial policy goals and the realities of corporate performance intertwined with political influence.
A very complex situation.
Yeah.
Okay, moving to immigration. The Wall Street Journal reports a concerning trend. Migrants are vanishing into an opaque, icy detention system characterized by frequent long-distance transfers. That we have families and lawyers struggling profoundly to keep track of people facing deportation. Critics argue this practice severely undermines their legal defense and raises serious questions about due process.
One striking detail the Journal report provides details heartbreaking cases like that of Felix Morales Reyna, a 28-year-old Mexican father. He was shuttled through detention centers across four states, Oklahoma, Colorado, New Mexico, and California, often without his family or lawyers receiving any prior notice.
Four states. How can anyone manage a legal case like that?
Exactly. Simultaneously, his legal case bounced through at least three different jurisdictions, forcing his paralegal to refile a bond motion an astonishing 20 times due to these jurisdictional issues.
20 times. Unbelievable.
While the Department of Homeland Security denies disappearing people, stating transfers are based on dead space and that due process is followed, immigrant advocates vehemently argue that these transfers amount to a denial of a constitutional right to due process.
Because they can't access lawyers or courts.
Precisely. Often placing detainees so far from legal counsel that it becomes impossible for them to access mandatory court hearings or even be located by their legal teams. This brings to the forefront a crucial consideration: the alarming trend of increased detainee deaths.
Oh no.
ICE is currently on track for its deadliest year on record, having logged 12 deaths since January. Compounding these concerns, the journal reveals President Trump plans to send immigrant detainees to the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola.
Angola, the maximum security prison.
Yes, a facility with a dark and brutal history, once notoriously known as the bloodiest prison in the country. Critics like the ACLU call this move profoundly disturbing, suggesting an intent to create sadistic terror in immigrant communities by utilizing a facility typically reserved for violent offenders serving life sentences.
That's deeply unsettling. And speaking of politically charged moves that redefine fundamental systems, President Trump has issued an order to the census to exclude immigrants living in the U.S. illegally from the calculations used to apportion House seats.
Right, the apportionment issue. This is huge.
Yeah. It directly challenges a 2019 Supreme Court decision that halted his first administration's plans to ask about citizenship on the 2020 census. And the ACLU states this new version would unequivocally defy the Constitution. This is a monumental decision with profound and long-term electoral implications, potentially shifting significant political power.
Absolutely. And placing this within the wider context, this move is a stark example of how fundamental democratic processes like the census can become highly politicized battlegrounds for political power.
We're seeing that elsewhere too, aren't we?
Definitely. Similar dynamics are aggressively playing out in Texas, where Senator John Cornyn recently announced the FBI would help track down Democratic lawmakers who fled the state to block a GOP redistricting bill aimed at shifting House seats.
The FBI getting involved in a state legislative dispute.
Yes. Democrats have fiercely criticized this as an authoritarian tactic. And while the FBI's legal authority in such a matter remains unclear, Governor Greg Abbott has already ordered the Texas Rangers to investigate the Democrats' fundraising efforts as potential bribery, and has even openly suggested their removal from office.
Wow, that's intense political maneuvering.
It highlights the escalating partisan struggle over the very definition of political representation and the integrity of democratic processes, extending far beyond simple policy disagreements into fundamental questions about how our system operates and who is represented.
In another interesting twist in the political landscape, Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan. You know, the Democrat widely credited for turning the city around after its municipal bankruptcy.
Yeah. Quite a turnaround story there.
He's now making a bold move. He's ditching the party to run for Michigan governor as an independent.
Really? Leaving the Democratic Party?
Yes. He articulates his reasoning by arguing that the identity of the Democratic Party is we hate Republicans in general, and we hate Donald Trump specifically, contending that this hyper-partisanship actively prevents any real work from getting done. He genuinely believes both major parties have dramatically strayed from their original principles since he was growing up.
That's a fascinating rationale. What truly stands out here is how Duggan's audacious move reflects a broader, discernible trend across the American electorate, with increasing numbers of Americans registering as unaffiliated voters.
Yeah, that number keeps growing.
The journal surveys dating back to 1990 show that both major parties are currently viewed negatively by a majority of Americans, and the Democratic brand specifically is at its lowest point, with 63% of voters holding an unfavorable view.
63% unfavorable for Democrats. That's significant.
It is. This begs the question: what is the future of political parties in an increasingly polarized nation? And can independent candidates truly disrupt the entrenched two-party system? Or do they, as some pollsters suggest, merely give the race to one of the major parties by siphoning votes?
The spoiler effect.
Exactly. While Duggan has successfully raised significant campaign funds, early polling shows him leading only in the Detroit metro area, while lagging considerably in the rest of the state. It's a fascinating test case for whether a nonpartisan approach can gain genuine statewide traction in such a deeply polarized environment.
Definitely one to watch. Okay, moving from the intricate world of politics to critical public health concerns. A new CDC report featured in the journal reveals a striking dietary finding. Ultra-processed foods now constitute more than 50% of American calories.
More than half our calories.
Wow. Although, interestingly, people are consuming fewer of them than in the past. It's a significant piece of research into our nation's eating habits.
This represents a critical public health issue that's drawing significant attention. HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been rigorously scrutinizing these foods, directly blaming them for the country's escalating obesity epidemic and citing specific ailments they cause.
He's been quite vocal on this.
Very. The Trump administration's Make America Healthy Again report also explicitly criticized federal dietary guidelines for not adequately addressing the prevalence of ultra-processed foods. Now, the HHS is committed to developing a clearer, universally accepted definition for these foods to promote greater consumer transparency.
So we might actually get a stand definition soon.
That's the plan. What truly stands out in the CDC report, though, is the stark socioeconomic disparity it highlights. Adults with higher family incomes consume a significantly lower percentage of calories from ultra-processed foods compared to those with lower incomes.
The income gap again.
Yeah, this begs the question. What are the underlying systemic factors contributing to these dietary patterns? Beyond individual choices, this points to crucial considerations around the accessibility and affordability of healthier food options and the pervasive marketing of cheaper, less nutritious alternatives.
Right. It's not just about willpower. And speaking of less pleasant realities, in Florida, a development boom near St. Augustine has inadvertently met a truly malodorous reality.
Malodorous? What's going on?
Residents are raising a huge stink, quite literally, over the increasing presence of sewage sludge or biosolids from a company called Indian Head Biomass, which mixes it with yard debris to create compost.
Okay, composting biosolids. That sounds environmentally friendly in theory.
In theory, yes. Oh. But neighbors have filed over 1,200 complaints, vividly describing how the foul, pervasive odors have forced them to cancel cherished backyard parties, barbecues, and outdoor gatherings.
1,200 complaints. That's a lot of unhappy neighbors.
It is.
Placing this within the wider context, this is a classic challenge faced by rapidly growing areas trying to manage waste. While using biosolids for compost offers clear environmental benefits, such as saving valuable landfill space and replacing synthetic fertilizers.
Right, the upside.
The creep of development means residential areas are encroaching on these facilities, leading directly to nuisance odors. St. Johns County, for its part, spends $106,000 a ton to ship biosolids to Indian Head, which is significantly cheaper than the nearest alternative, a landfill 160 miles away.
So it's a cost incentive for the county.
Absolutely. The journal also notes that population growth in the area is expected to dramatically boost annual biosolid shipments to over 20,000 tons by 2035, up from 12,000 today.
So the problem could get worse.
Potentially, yes. This highlights the complex balancing act between accommodating urban growth, implementing sustainable waste management practices, and preserving the quality of life for long-term residents. The aggrieved residents have even filed a lawsuit alleging nuisance and negligence, aiming to block a permit for the facility, escalating this local issue into a significant legal and environmental battle.
A classic NIMBYA. Not in my backyard situation, but with a very potent smell.
You could say that.
And finally, in New York City, Mayor Eric Adams recently announced a new 15-mile-an-hour speed limit for e-bikes and e-scooters.
Ah, the e-bike debate.
A move broadly welcomed by many critics who increasingly view them as an urban menace, creating hazards for pedestrians and traffic alike. But the truly intriguing aspect emerges when you consider that, as of now, there's currently no clear or practical way to enforce it.
No way to enforce it. How so?
Well,
one striking detail the journal highlights is the fundamental enforcement problem. E-bikes typically don't have speedometers or vehicle registrations, which makes it virtually impossible for traffic cameras to ticket them.
Right. No license plates, no easy tracking.
Exactly. Remarkably, City Hall, the Department of Transportation, and the NYPD have all, in essence, punted on how this policy will actually be enforced, and even city council members weren't consulted before the announcement.
So, an announcement without an execution plan.
Seems like it.
Mm.
This begs the question, how feasible is it to regulate emerging technologies, especially when they're so deeply integrated into the city's daily operations? Consider that over 30,000 delivery workers rely on these bikes and their speed for timely drop-offs.
Their livelihoods depend on speed.
Often working from multiple platforms with incredibly tight deadlines where every minute impacts their livelihood. As it stands, only City Bikes pedal-assist bikes will be automatically adjusted to the new speed limit, private e-bikes, which can reach speeds up to 28 mile per hour, remain completely unaffected.
So it only affects a fraction of the bikes, and the ones most likely causing issues are untouched.
Pretty much. It genuinely feels like a policy put in place without a clear roadmap for its implementation or consideration for its real-world impact.
Okay, let's shift now to the cutting edge of technology, a domain that continues to redefine our future. OpenAI has just unveiled GPT-5, their most powerful AI model to date.
GPT-5. The anticipation has been high.
CEO Sam Altman describes interacting with it as really feeling like talking to an expert in any topic, like a PhD-level expert.
This sounds like a monumental leap forward in artificial intelligence.
It really does. What truly stands out here is Altman's emphasis on GPT-5's revolutionary ability to empower anyone to create sophisticated software applications simply by typing in plain English language prompts.
They're calling it vibe coding.
That's the term, yeah. Vibe coding. In a compelling demo, an OpenAI researcher created a functional web application to teach French in mere minutes, writing over 300 lines of code without a single line of traditional coding.
Wow, that's potentially game-changing for software development. Absolutely. This release follows a year of truly massive revenue growth for OpenAI, which recently hit an astonishing $10 billion in annualized revenue. The company is now in talks for a secondary stock sale that would value it at an incredible $500 billion.
$500 billion.
Potentially making it the world's most valuable private company. This begs the question, how rapidly is AI advancing, and what are its truly transformative potentials across industries, even as the company faces intensifying competition and complex regulatory challenges?
And the journal mentioned some technical hurdles they overcame.
Yes, it delves into that. Microsoft had initially expected to review the model around mid-2024, but OpenAI researchers encountered unexpected obstacles, including a shortage of high-quality data. They overcame this by making new breakthroughs, specifically by teaching AI models how to think, for longer integrating more sophisticated reasoning models into ChatGPT.
Teaching AI to think.
That's the framing. They also trained GPT-5 to reduce sycophantic behavior, basically trying too hard to please the user, and improve its responses in mental health scenarios, indicating a focus not just on power, but also on nuanced, helpful interaction.
So it's not just more powerful, but maybe more responsible.
That seems to be the goal. It suggests AI is moving beyond sophisticated pattern recognition to simulate logical thought processes, enabling more coherent step-by-step solutions for complex problems.
Fascinating stuff. And speaking of groundbreaking tech companies, Firefly Aerospace, a Texas-based space company, just saw its stock zoom in its Wall Street debut.
Oh yeah, the Firefly IPO.
Closing at $60.35. well above its IPO price of $45. This signals exceptionally strong investor confidence in the commercial space sector.
Placing this within the wider context, Firefly's highly successful debut, which raised an impressive $868 million by selling over 19 million shares, is a strong indicator of both a strengthening U.S. IPO market and a burgeoning investor interest in space companies.
That follows Figma's big jump too, right?
Yeah, exactly. This success follows closely on the heels of Figma stock jumping an incredible 250% in its own listing. And Firefly itself ended up raising its targeted price range and selling more shares than planned due to overwhelming demand.
And they had that successful moon landing, too.
Right. That's key context. This success is underpinned by Firefly's recent achievement earlier this year. They successfully guided their Blue Ghost lander to the lunar surface, marking the first fully successful private moon landing.
A huge milestone for private spaceflight.
Absolutely. This achievement signals a new era of commercial space exploration, one increasingly driven and funded by private capital, showing that investors are indeed becoming increasingly bullish on the future of space as a viable and profitable frontier.
Okay, turning to quarterly earnings reports. The journal reveals a truly mixed bag across various sectors, reflecting both innovative growth and persistent economic pressures. Warner Bros. Discovery, for instance. They topped revenue estimates and impressively swung to a profit of $1.58 billion this quarter.
Good news for them.
Largely driven by its successful theatrical releases, including a Minecraft movie, and a healthy surge in streaming subscriptions.
What truly stands out here is how traditional media companies are strategically navigating the seismic shift away from linear TV. Warner Bros. Discovery appears to be finding a profitable path in that complex transition, leveraging its content library effectively.
But not everyone's doing so well.
No. Conversely, WPP, the global advertising giant, delivered a more cautionary tale. It halved its dividend and is undergoing a significant strategy review as it braces for the full impact of the AI era.
Halved its dividend. Ouch.
Yeah. The company reported its worst quarterly decline in like-for-like revenue since the pandemic, severely hurt by client losses and tariff-induced caution among marketers, meaning businesses are pulling back on advertising due to economic uncertainty from trade policies.
The tariffs hitting advertising spend.
Exactly. This clearly demonstrates the disruptive potential of both AI and global trade policies on even long-established industries. SoftBank Group, on the other hand, posted a quarterly profit of $2.86 billion.
SoftBank's back in the black.
With substantial gains from its stakes in companies like NVIDIA, unequivocally signaling how its AI bet pays off. While their ambitious half-trillion-dollar Stargate AI infrastructure project with OpenAI is still struggling to get off the ground in its near-term plans, SoftBank CEO highlighted their strong AI business, reaffirming their commitment to the sector.
So, a mixed picture in media and tech investment.
Yeah.
What about industrials and consumer goods?
In the industrial sector, Siemens beat market views with impressive order momentum in its mobility business, seeing orders triple due to a massive 3.5 billion rail system agreement in Egypt.
3.5 billion euros. That's a huge contract.
It is. This substantial deal involves building a new, modern high-speed rail network across the country. However, their digital industries segment saw both orders and revenue drop, indicating uneven performance even within large diversified conglomerates.
Okay. And Peloton.
Meanwhile, Peloton, the connected fitness company, swung to a fiscal fourth quarter profit of $21.6 million, a positive sign, but cautioned investors about further sales declines in 2025.
Uh-oh. More trouble ahead.
Seems likely. This warning prompted further layoffs and cost-cutting measures, as the company anticipates continued decreases in sales of its fitness machines and subscriptions, and the shares of Crocs, the popular footwear company.
Crocs? What happened there?
They were pummeled, dropping a staggering 26% after guiding for a sales decline in the current quarter and holding off on providing full-year guidance. They cited broad market uncertainty and the impact of tariffs, despite a modest 5% rise in their namesake brand's revenue.
26% drop. Wow. Tariffs hitting footwear, too.
It seems so. Placing this within the wider context, Maersk, the Danish shipping giant, offers an interesting counterpoint, having raised its full-year guidance.
Maersk is doing better. Despite the trade issues.
Yes. They cited resilient demand outside North America, even as Trump's tariffs caused a significant 30-40% drop in trade volumes on routes from China to the U.S. Maersk's CEO highlighted that China continues to generate market demand globally, demonstrating a clear redirection of trade lines.
The redirection theme again.
Exactly. Underscoring how global trade dynamics are shifting in response to specific policy actions. On the consumer front, Krispy Kreme reported a wider loss of $435.3 million, primarily due to impairment charges and lower sales.
Ouch. Not a sweet quarter for them.
Not at all. Restaurant Brands International, the parent company of Burger King, also saw profits squeezed by higher costs, though their international segment, particularly Burger King International and Tim Hortons Canada, showed strong comparable sales growth.
So international strength offsetting domestic weakness.
In some cases, yes. This begs the question, how are global economic volatility and specific trade policies impacting diverse industries in such a disparate ways? We're seeing some sectors thriving, particularly internationally, or where strategic redirection is possible, while others grapple with significant and persistent headwinds directly linked to tariffs and economic uncertainty.
And perhaps a truly classic American story. Disney's thriving theme parks are effectively buying the company precious time to figure out its long-term streaming strategy.
Oh, yeah, the Magic Kingdom still got it.
The Journal reports that domestic parks saw revenue jump an impressive 10% to $6.4 billion, and operating income surged a remarkable 22% to nearly $1.7 billion. This growth occurred even with a major new competitor, Universal's Epic Universe, opening nearby in Orlando.
Holding their own against new competition.
Signaling Disney's remarkable resilience in the highly competitive leisure market.
What truly stands out here is how Disney's parks, alongside their fast-growing cruise business, are effectively offsetting slower growth in its entertainment and sports divisions. Walt Disney World, in particular, reported record revenue for the June-ending quarter.
Record revenue, wow.
Which provides a crucial financial cushion for Disney as it endeavors to catch up in the intensely competitive streaming race. While Disney has amassed over 125 million subscribers across Disney+, Hulu, and ESPN, they still significantly trail Netflix in terms of operating margins and subscriber numbers.
So the parks are funding the streaming wars, basically.
In large part, yes. This means the sustained strength of their legacy parks and the burgeoning cruise line are providing the necessary capital and breathing room for Disney to invest heavily and innovate in its digital streaming future, navigating the evolving media landscape from a position of relative strength rather than weakness.
Okay, back to policy. President Trump is also shaking up Wall Street with a pair of executive orders, both aimed at significantly altering financial policy. One order aims to make it easier for everyday Americans to invest their retirement savings in assets typically outside public markets.
Things like private equity, crypto.
Exactly. Private equity, cryptocurrency, and private real estate.
One striking detail the journal highlights is that this executive order fulfills a long-sought goal of powerful Wall Street hedge funds and private equity firms who are eager to tap into the colossal pool of money held in 401k and other defined contribution plans.
Tapping into retirement funds. What are the arguments for and against?
Well, proponents argue this move could offer potentially higher returns for retirement savers, enabling them to access a broader range of lucrative, less correlated investments. However, these types of investments tend to be considerably harder to buy and sell, and they often come with significantly higher fees.
Less liquidity, higher fees. Sounds risky for average savers.
It raises important questions about the balance between expanding investment access and ensuring robust consumer protection, especially when it comes to the retirement savings of average Americans who may not possess the expertise to navigate these complex, less liquid assets and the associated risks. Furthermore, there are concerns about increased litigation risk for employers offering these options, as they could be held responsible if investments underperform.
Okay, and the second executive order?
The second executive order targets what's commonly being called debanking, directing regulators to investigate whether banks are discriminating against individuals or entities on political or religious grounds.
The debanking issue. This has been a hot topic.
Very much so. Placing this within the wider context, this order is a direct response to concerns, amplified by President Trump himself and various advocacy groups, that banks like JPMorgan Chase and Bank of America have denied accounts or financial services based on political or religious affiliations.
So the administration is siding with those concerns?
Yes. While banks frequently cite reputational risk pressures from regulators as their rationale for dropping certain customers, for example, those involved in controversial industries or political activities, the executive order explicitly directs regulators to withdraw policies that could lead to debanking, specifically targeting the use of reputational risk as a blanket justification.
Trying to limit banks' ability to use that reason.
Exactly. This highlights the ongoing tension between financial institutions' operational autonomy and increasing political pressures from various stakeholders seeking to influence lending and account decisions. Interestingly, the journal also notes a practical example of companies navigating these complex policy environments, General Motors.
Use them again.
Yes, they will temporarily import EV batteries from China's CATL for its new Chevrolet Bolt, despite Trump's tariffs, as a stopgap measure until its U.S. production venture with LG can ramp up in 2027.
So even with tariffs, they're still importing key components from China when needed.
It demonstrates the strategic choices companies make to maintain production and meet demand, sometimes even against the stated policy aims of the administration. Practicality sometimes outweighs policy.
Okay, let's step away from the economy headlines for a moment and turn to the captivating world of arts and culture, where stories often reflect deeper societal currents. Roman Polanski's historical film, An Officer and a Spy.
Ah, the Polanski film. Controversial.
Focusing on an unlikely hero in the infamous Dreyfus affair, it's finally receiving its first official U.S. showing. This is a film that was originally released in France way back in 2019.
What truly stands out here is how the journal's reviewer directly addresses the enduring controversy surrounding Polanski's past, specifically his 1977 guilty plea to unlawful sexual intercourse with a minor and his subsequent flight from the U.S.
Yeah, that always comes up.
However, the reviewer argues that audiences should still have the opportunity to judge the work on its own merits, separating the art from the artist. The film itself offers a fascinating historical deep dive into the Dreyfus Affair, a notorious political scandal that rocked late 19th century France.
What's the core story?
It centers on Georges Picquart, an initially anti-Semitic officer who, through a rigorous pursuit of justice and truth, uncovers the wrongful conviction of Alfred Dreyfus for spying. The film powerfully highlights the crucial, transformative role of the press, featuring a pivotal scene depicting Emile Zola's incendiary J'accuse column, which became a landmark in investigative journalism.
A story about truth and justice overcoming prejudice.
Exactly. And this begs the question, how do we reconcile the morality of an artist's personal life with the artistic value and historical relevance of their work? And more broadly, the film serves as a timeless reminder of the struggle for justice against deeply entrenched institutional anti-Semitism, a theme that, tragically, remains relevant in many forms today.
A complex issue. Moving on, Netflix has a new documentary making waves called Stolen, Heist of the Century, about the infamous 2003 Antwerp diamond robbery.
The Antwerp diamond heist, classic crime story.
Where an estimated $100 million in diamonds simply vanished into thin air.
Placing this within the wider context, this bare-bones yet incredibly engaging documentary draws its strength from relying heavily on the frank commentary of both the investigators, Adjim de Bruycker and Patrick Pays, and remarkably, the convicted criminal mastermind himself, Leonardo Notarbartolo.
They got the actual robber to talk.
Yeah, apparently, quite frankly. What truly stands out here is how it vividly reveals the sheer audacity and meticulous detailed planning of the crime, particularly given that the Diamond Center was presumed impregnable.
Right, supposed to be impossible to break into.
The journal notes the center was equipped with 24-hour cameras, seemingly impregnable vaults, and multiple lock combinations. The film even includes a moment of dry, dark humor where a detective is told the alarms didn't go off, only for him to respond with perfectly delivered deadpan because I'm standing in the vault room and the door is wide open behind me.
Uh-huh, I love that.
It's a nonfiction account that possesses all the compelling mechanics of a great heist film, focusing not just on the physical break-in, but on the words and patience required to infiltrate such a secure place. It's a testament to the power of human ingenuity, albeit for illicit purposes.
Sounds fascinating. On stage, the accomplished actress Elizabeth McGovern has not only written but also stars in Ava, The Secret Conversations, where she portrays the iconic screen legend Ava Gardner.
Elizabeth McGovern playing Ava Gardner. Interesting casting.
It is.
What truly stands out here is McGovern's choice to cast herself, at 64, against type, to recreate Gardner's late-life meetings with a journalist named Peter Evans, where Gardner recounts her life story.
So it's based on real interviews.
Yes. The play masterfully weaves in flashback scenes that delve deep into Gardner's complex and often tumultuous relationships with figures like Mickey Rooney, Artie Shaw, and offers a particularly developed and poignant portrayal of Frank Sinatra during a low point in his career.
Ah, Sinatra, their relationship was legendary.
It was. It offers a rare glimpse into the complex realities that lay behind the glittering public persona of a Hollywood star, showing the real, often vulnerable person behind the shimmering beauty and legendary glamour.
Okay, moving to the big screen. Zach Cregger, the director behind the hit horror film Barbarian.
Oh, Barbarian was something else. Very effective horror.
He has a new communal horror film titled Weapons, starring Josh Brolin and Julia Garner. Its premise is truly chilling. 17 third-grade students disappear on the same night, all at precisely 2.17 a.m.
17 kids. Wow, that's disturbing.
It is.
The journal's review highlights that this film reportedly arrives in a world raw with large-scale grief, implicitly referencing the ongoing traumas of school violence and collective sorrow. It explores the aftermath of this mysterious tragedy from multiple perspectives within the community, depicting it convulsing with pain, profound uncertainty, and increasingly strange supernatural happenings.
Sounds intense. Does it work?
Well, the reviewer notes that while the film initially shimmers with mystery and metaphor, its denouement, or resolution, may ultimately fall short of its ambitious setup. However, it undeniably taps deeply into a father's overwhelming grief and employs powerful, disturbing imagery, such as a huge assault rifle ominously looming like a storm cloud, to hint at a nation tormented by the pervasive threat of violence against its youngest.
So ambitious, maybe flawed, but powerful imagery.
That seems to be the takeaway. It's an ambitious horror film that bravely delves into deeply contemporary anxieties.
And on CNN, a new three-part documentary series is offering what's being described as an affectionate portrait titled American Prince JFK Jr.
JFK Jr. is still such a mythic figure.
He is.
What truly stands out here is how the series comprehensively follows the life of John F. Kennedy Jr., who would have been 64 today. It explores his life from the iconic image of the little boy saluting his father's casket to his adult years as a Manhattan prosecutor and the founder of George Magazine.
Covering his whole life.
Yes. While it's largely presented as a biographical bouquet, it also includes surprisingly frank insights from magazine contemporaries who discussed JFK Jr.'s shortcomings as an editor.
Really? Like what?
such as his tendency to cancel stories due to personal discomfort or his reluctance to cover scandals too close to his famous family's past. The series draws compelling parallels to Princess Diana's tragic death, offering a critique of the star-driven media of the pre-internet era that relentlessly pursued him and his wife, Carolyn Bessett Kennedy.
The price of fame, and that particular kind of fame.
Exactly. This begs the question, what are the profound pressures of a public legacy, and how does the relentless scrutiny faced by those born into prominent families impact their personal and professional choices, their ability to forge their own identity?
A timeless question for figures like him. Okay, from the media spotlight to the sports field. It's already football season for the media, even in August.
Huh, never too early for football hype.
The Journal has a fascinating piece on what it calls Shedder Sanders and the most meaningful, meaningless NFL game ever.
Shedder Sanders, Stein's son, right. What's this about?
Well,
what truly stands out here is the sheer, undeniable dominance of the NFL in American culture. This piece refers specifically to a Cleveland Browns preseason game, which would typically be dismissed as meaningless. However, it transformed into a major event simply because of the surprise start of Shedder Sanders.
Just his presence made a preseason game meaningful.
According to the article, yes. It powerfully highlights how the NFL has effectively become the final gasp of American monoculture, consuming an unparalleled amount of attention and power. This pervasive influence manifests in everything from dedicated quarterback reality shows and ubiquitous celebrity endorsements to the league's success in getting flag football included in the Olympics.
The NFL's cultural power is immense.
It truly is. It's a testament to the league's ability to transcend sport and permeate every aspect of American entertainment and identity.
And in a move that's not sitting well with some players, the NFL is reportedly cracking down on the use of smelling salts.
Oh, smelling salts. That's a classic sideline thing. Why the crackdown?
Well,
this brings to the forefront a crucial consideration, the ongoing tension between deeply ingrained player tradition and evolving player safety protocols. The NFL has officially banned teams from providing smelling salts, those pungent packets of ammonia, citing concerns that they lack any legitimate medical backing, and more critically, could mask serious neurological symptoms, particularly concussions.
The concussion concern makes sense.
Right. The FDA even issued a public warning last year about these products, noting adverse effects like coughing and shortness of breath. However, players like San Francisco 49ers tight end George Kittle are reportedly distraught by the ban.
Kittle. He's a big personality. Yeah,
saying he uses them before every single drive, illustrating a strong, almost ritualistic reliance on these substances. Interestingly, the NFL Players Association has pushed back on the league's stance, clarifying that players aren't actually prohibited from using them if they bring the substances themselves.
Oh, so they can still bring their own.
Apparently so, according to the union, highlighting the ongoing debate between individual player choice and broader league-wide safety regulations.
Interesting loophole. Okay, moving into the opinion section. There's a compelling piece arguing the case for the atomic bomb 80 years later, revisiting the complex math and morality of the Allied forces' decision to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Wow. Tackling a hugely controversial topic. What truly stands out here is the author's controversial yet meticulously argued contention that using the atomic bombs was not only morally justifiable, but ultimately saved lives, both Allied and Japanese.
Saved lives by using the bomb? How?
The author points to the Japanese government's unwavering pledge to fight to the bitter end, including their extensive plans for mass casualties involving civilian kamikaze units and human mines tactics vividly demonstrated in battles like Okinawa, where U.S. forces suffered extremely high attrition rates.
Right, the projected invasion casualties were horrific.
Exactly. The piece contends that the atomic bombs prevented an even deadlier invasion of the Japanese home islands, an operation that military planners estimated would have resulted in hundreds of thousands of Allied casualties and millions of Japanese deaths, including countless civilians who would have starved or perished in a prolonged land war.
So the argument is it was the lesser of two evils.
That's the core of it. The author even cites a poignant historical detail. The former president of the Japanese Medical Association, after the war, remarkably described the bomb as having saved Japan. This begs the question. How do we grapple with the agonizing decisions made during wartime? And how are historical events reevaluated through the lens of long-term consequences and the ultimate preservation of life, often challenging conventional wisdom and forcing uncomfortable reassessments?
Very heavy topic. There's also an interesting take on modern parenting with Don't Fool Around with FAFO Parenting.
FAFO Parenting, what's that stand for?
It critiques the latest child-rearing fad, short for Fool Around and Find Out.
Ah, okay. So a tough love approach.
Kind of, but the article is critical. This opinion piece argues that FAFO parenting, which elevates consequences over more gentle parenting methods, dangerously confuses humiliation for genuine discipline. How so?
The author provides stark examples. If a child didn't feed the dog, no food for you, or forcing a child to complete an after-school activity simply because the gear was already purchased. The piece carefully distinguishes between natural consequences, which genuinely teach responsibility by allowing children to experience the direct logical outcome of their actions, and manufactured punishments, which, the author argues, can erode trust and primarily serve to humiliate rather than educate.
So, natural consequences good, manufactured humiliation bad.
That's the gist. This highlights a fascinating and ongoing societal debate about different philosophical approaches to child development and discipline, and the potential pitfalls of blindly adopting parenting trends without fully considering their long-term psychological impact on children.
Makes sense. And finally, a critical opinion piece on the folly of California's green energy future.
California's energy policy is always a hot topic. What's the argument here?
Arguing that the state's aggressive embrace of renewables largely ignores significant industry loss, a dangerous supply chain dependence on China, and skyrocketing energy costs for its residents and businesses.
Placing this within the wider context, this piece contends that California's industrial energy costs are now more than double those in Arizona and Florida, and a staggering triple those in states like Texas, Tennessee, and Nevada.
Triple the cost. That's a huge disadvantage for businesses.
Absolutely. This immense cost disparity, the author argues, is a primary driver for businesses leaving the state, impacting its economic vitality. It also raises serious national security concerns, claiming the state depends heavily on Chinese-controlled wind, solar, and battery technologies, with over 70% of batteries and inverters used in California made in China.
A China dependency argument.
Yes. The author even reports chilling allegations of rogue communications devices found on Chinese batteries that could, theoretically, allow for remote control or disruption of the state's energy grid. This piece goes further, linking this dependency to alleged Chinese Communist Party influence operations.
Whoa, that's a strong claim.
Suggesting that organizations like the Energy Foundation China, which champions California's green policies, are in fact fronts for advancing the party's geopolitical interests. This begs the question. What are the true, comprehensive costs and strategic vulnerabilities of pursuing ambitious green energy goals without first establishing a robust domestic supply chain and fully integrating comprehensive national security considerations, especially given California's status as having the second highest electricity costs in the U.S. and its significant reliance on energy imports?
A critical perspective on the energy transition, for sure. Okay, now let's turn our attention to the opulent world of real estate, specifically for those who truly have it all. The journal reports on the homeowners who decided that having just one pool wasn't enough.
One pool isn't enough. Must be nice.
Right.
What truly stands out here is a fascinating and growing trend among the ultra-wealthy to build both indoor and outdoor pools, particularly in colder climates, where one might expect only indoor options.
Indoor and outdoor.
Right. Why? This phenomenon is largely driven by a post-pandemic sanctuary and wellness mindset, where homeowners are investing heavily in creating more luxurious amenities within their homes for exercise, mental detachment, and relaxation. The journal cites compelling examples like a Boulder, Colorado home boasting both indoor and outdoor pools listed for nearly $30
million. $30
million. And an astonishing $78 million property in Vail featuring an indoor pool alongside four outdoor pools.
Four outdoor pools plus an indoor one. Good grief.
While indoor pools are considerably more expensive to build and maintain due to complex needs for heating, cooling, and ventilation, this trend highlights how extreme luxury is adapting to new lifestyle priorities, moving beyond mere indulgence to genuinely incorporate a focus on comprehensive well-being and year-round access to recreation within the private residence.
Wellness through multiple pools. Great. Got it. The journal also spotlights three California homes, three chances to bring their colorful, eclectic vision to life, focusing on Paramount Global Streaming CEO Tom Ryan and his wife, Anjanette Padilla Ryan.
Ah, the CEO's homes.
Who brilliantly hired one design firm to renovate their Hollywood Hills, Malibu, and Palm Springs properties, creating a cohesive aesthetic across their diverse portfolio.
Placing this within the wider context, this article offers a compelling look into how high-profile figures integrate their professional lives, personal tastes, and strategic investments into their private spaces. Their Hollywood Hills estate underwent a significant $1.8 million renovation, transforming it into a vibrant, art-filled retreat.
Oh, okay.
Their Malibu home, which served as their full-time residence during the pandemic, saw a substantial $1 million interior overhaul to align with their evolving lifestyle. Most interestingly, their Palm Springs Hacienda, acquired for $8.38 million, is now being strategically used as a large-scale rental property.
Renting out the Palm Springs place? For how much?
Commanding around $8,000 a night in high season.
$8,000 a night. Wow.
This begs the question. How is the convergence of personal luxury, strategic investment, and the pursuit of a particular aesthetic vision playing out on such a grand scale, effectively blurring the lines between a private residence and a lucrative business venture? It's a testament to how creative wealth management is adapting to new opportunities.
Absolutely. And in other high-profile LA real estate news, billionaire AI co-founder Lucy Guo, at just 30 years old, paid nearly $30 million for a newly constructed mansion in the Hollywood Hills.
$30 million at 30 years old, AI money is flowing.
But though it was a significant discount from its original $43 million asking price, and former Google chief Eric Schmidt made an even more monumental purchase, acquiring LA's storied Spelling Manor for $110 million.
Spelling Manor, that place is legendary and huge.
A property famously larger than the White House.
What truly stands out here is that both of these transactions reflect a challenged luxury market in LA, with many high-end sales closing at significant discounts due to factors like recent wildfires, outward migration of wealthy residents to lower tax states, and broader economic uncertainty.
So even billionaires are getting discounts in LA right now.
It seems so. Schmidt's purchase of Spelling Manor, however, is particularly intriguing because he and his wife primarily intend to use it not just as a personal residence, but to host meetings and events for LA nonprofits and cultural institutions.
Using it for philanthropy.
Showcasing a clear blend of personal acquisition and philanthropic intent. This highlights how wealth is being deployed in increasingly diverse ways, even in the luxury real estate sector, moving beyond pure personal consumption to serve broader community and strategic objectives.
Interesting use of such a massive property. On a more poignant note, the longtime Malibu home of the beloved actress Shannon Doherty is coming onto the market following her passing last year.
Oh, that's sad. Her Malibu home.
This spacious 5,400 square foot house, which she bought for $2.56 million in 2004, will have its proceeds go to her mother, a touching testament to her legacy.
That's very moving. This brings to the forefront a crucial consideration. The intensely personal stories that often lie behind every real estate transaction, especially in a market like Malibu, where buyers are becoming increasingly selective about fire-safe homes following recent devastating wildfires.
Right. The fire risk is a huge factor there now.
Definitely. The journal notes that Doherty had poured significant personal effort and resources into the property, revamping it after suffering smoke damage from a 2018 fire. She meticulously filled it with unique furnishings and treasures from her extensive world travels, making it truly her own.
A home filled with personal history.
It's a powerful reminder that even in the most exclusive and high-value markets, real estate is deeply intertwined with personal legacies, life events, and the emotional investments individuals make in their homes.
Absolutely. And finally, in real estate, we have the truly unconventional story of LASIK pioneer David Mueller and his wife, Jen Stone.
LASIK pioneer, David Mueller. Okay.
Who in 2020 bought a 65-acre Vermont farmhouse at a foreclosure auction, sight unseen.
Sight unseen at auction. That takes guts.
Doesn't it? They then completely reconfigured the property, building a breathtaking new residence with a floating staircase and massive glass walls to optimize views of the stunning Green Mountains.
What truly stands out here is how Mueller, a serial entrepreneur known for his visionary approach, essentially applied that same mindset to real estate. They undertook a radical transformation, razing old structures, including a century-old residence, and even strategically selling an antique barn to facilitate relocating the main residence for optimal, unobstructed views.
So they basically redesigned the whole property around the view.
Pretty much. Now they're selling the remaining 65-acre farm portion, as Mueller has retired, and they're itchy for the coast, demonstrating how personal passions, evolving life stages, and a keen eye for opportunity can drive significant real estate decisions, even in unconventional ways, like buying a property site unseen and then completely reinventing it.
Retiring and heading for the coast. A familiar story, but done in a very unique way.
This highlights the adaptability of successful individuals and how they meticulously shape their environments to fit their evolving needs and desires.
Okay, to round out our deep dive, we have a fascinating house call interview with Louisa Jacobson, the talented actress from The Gilded Age.
Ah, from The Gilded Age. She's great in that.
Who also happens to be Meryl Streep's daughter. She shares what she learned from her iconic mother.
Meryl Streep's daughter. Always interesting to hear about those family dynamics. What does she share?
Well,
what truly stands out here is Jacobson's upbringing in a highly artistic household steeped in creativity, with her sculptor father, Don Gummer, and her renowned actress mother, Meryl Streep. She describes a childhood where imaginary play and sketching were not just encouraged, but were daily rituals.
Sounds like a very creative environment.
Definitely. She characterizes her mother as very present during her childhood, fostering a nurturing environment. This begs the question, what is the intricate interplay of nature and nurture in the development of artistic talent and personal identity, especially when you come from such a distinguished lineage?
The age-old question, did she always want to act?
Actually, no. Jacobson initially charted a different course, pursuing psychology and working in retail and advertising, but ultimately found her way back to acting, feeling a creative muscle that was starting to ache.
The calling was too strong.
Apparently so. She shares a powerful piece of advice from her mother. A lot of acting is a great, deep, belief-like religious faith in what you are doing and in the character you're playing, suggesting that true performance requires profound conviction.
That's powerful advice. Believing in the role like religious faith.
It offers a unique and insightful perspective on forging a distinct path while still embracing the profound influence and lessons learned from a famous parent.
A fascinating look inside.
Yeah.
And that brings us to the end of our deep dive into the Wall Street Journal for Friday, August 8th, 2025.
Wow, we covered a lot of ground.
We really did. From the complexities of global trade wars and the delicate balance of geopolitical strategy to the cutting-edge advancements in AI and the deeply personal decisions shaping our homes and careers, today's journal truly offered a panoramic, illuminating view of the world.
Placing this within the wider context, what truly stands out across all these diverse stories is the constant dynamic interplay between grand policy decisions at the highest levels and their profound impact on individual lives and daily reality.
Yeah, that connection is key.
Whether it's the ripple effects of tariffs on our economy, the profound moral dilemmas embedded in global conflicts, or the shifting priorities in how we choose to live and work, understanding these nuances is absolutely key to navigating our increasingly complex world. It underscores how every headline, every market shift, and every personal story is not an isolated event, but rather part of a much larger, intricately interconnected narrative that shapes our present and future.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? As you go about your day, consider this provocative thought. In a world where AI is becoming a PhD-level expert, capable of transforming industries, and global trade policies are forcing companies to rethink entire supply chains, what unintended consequences or hidden opportunities might be emerging right under your nose, simply because you're now more deeply informed about the powerful forces shaping tomorrow.
Something to chew on. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time.
It was a pleasure diving in with you. Stay curious and stay informed.